We all seem to have multiple careers these days. Being a writer can allow us to explore the act of writing as well as explore other worlds. We speak with Carla Seiler about writing and domestic terrorism and our fragile balance of seed diversity. It's on Tip of the Tongue. Welcome to Tip of the Tongue, a podcast on the Nitty Grits Network, where we explore the intersection of food and drink and museums. This is Liz Williams. We're here today with Carla Seiler. After a career in vocational rehabilitation, she began a long postponed writing career in earnest. A native of New Orleans, she has written a book called A Place Unmade, about balancing care for the earth with greed. Welcome, Carla.
Thank you so much.
So I really, really enjoyed this book. I learned a lot more about drones than I ever thought I would, but it was really an interesting perspective. So why don't you tell us a little bit about why you called it A Place Unmade and how you settled on this theme for your book?
Sure. Well, the title came much later than the book itself. I got interested in the subject because I saw an article or the title of an article called Save Our Food, Free the Seed. And it was by Dan Barber, a New York restaurateur and actual independent seed grower. And so I read this article and I felt like, how could I not have known about this? And what it was about was that our food supply is vulnerable because we have so little biodiversity in our seeds. And I just thought, how could everyone not know this? How could I have not known this? And so that drove me to write the book. Later, much later, a title was kind of hard to come up with. And during my research, and I did a lot of research to write this book, I came across Wendell Berry, who is, I think, probably one of our first environmental scientists, and certainly someone who is very focused on the independent farmer. And so his poetry, I thought, was an excellent theme for what I was trying to write.
So, and the poem appears in the beginning of the book, which I think is really nice because it sets that phrase, A Place Unmade, in context, which is really, really nice. So did you have a long time of plotting? How did you go about doing this? Because it's kind of a mystery. It's kind of a tale that is like a cautionary tale. It's all sorts of things that happen on a local level as well as on a global level. And I think there's lots to be learned from the book. How did you plot it out?
Well, at first, I wanted to blow up a seed bank. And I thought that would be an excellent way of getting everyone's attention. But then I realized, well, why would anybody want to blow up a seed bank? And so I had to come up with something that some major food source that would be jeopardized. And so it really, that was the hardest part about the book, coming up with an idea where someone could jeopardize the global food supply. And so, you know, not to give anything away, in this case, it's an agricultural company executive who tries to corner the grain market. And once that happened, then it was like, okay, then the rest of the pieces started falling into place.
So that initial event, let's say the inciting event, reminded me of that big ball coming down after Indiana Jones. In the first Indiana Jones movie, you know, it's like, okay, now we have your attention.
Yes. It really was a lot of fun to just do this deep dive into all the agricultural issues and the particular vehicle for the disaster is real. And so how it, you know, how I managed to get it, you know, spread so widely is, you know, obviously fiction, but the actual virus is very much real. So.
And so are there actual seeds that are resistant to the virus that are sold now?
It's they have some, the wheat that is developed has some resistance, but not complete. A farmer to this day can still lose about 83% of his crop if it gets infected by the virus.
And what I think is so interesting as this virus is it affects so many different kinds of grain.
Yes, it does. Yes, it can affect corn, sorghum, I think barley, but certainly wheat.
Yeah.
Oh, and soy, you know, and so it just could be a complete disaster.
Oh. So how did you decide to talk about, well, I mean, I understand what you say about Dan Barber. Have you sent him a book?
I contacted his office and they indicated he's too busy. So
he doesn't want it. Oh, that's
you
awful.
know.
You should
It
send it
was.
to him anyway.
So I certainly probably have given him a lot of publicity.
Right. Yes, because you do mention him in the book, which I think is gives him, you know, gives it all a context.
Look,
So,
I acknowledge him. Yeah,
yes,
he's, I don't think
acknowledge.
he's actually in the book itself, but yeah, he's acknowledged.
So when you were working on this, do you think, did you come to feel that there are inequities in the food system? I mean, I'm specifically talking about the question of being able to trademark a seed and or own a seed that you have genetically engineered, and when through no fault of your own, there is wind drift or something that causes cross-pollination so that the DNA of this engineered seed mixes with your seed, and therefore you can't really seed save anymore because your seeds are now actually the seeds that belong to the engineering company.
Right.
The Supreme Court has acted on this. I don't know that when they did, they had the understanding of what the implications of that would be. But now it seems to have just gone all over the world so that it's virtually impossible to do any seed saving except if you are in a greenhouse or some other kind of really protected space.
I think it's an incredible problem. The Supreme Court allowed the patent of living organisms, I believe it was 1980. And
That's
so,
patent.
yes, it was a patent. And so then it was a short step to patenting seeds. And so what, to just give you a little history, what in the, from the 1800s to about 1923, farmers could save their seeds. And in fact, the U.S. Department of Agriculture used to give away seeds. And so there was this process where the independent farmer would develop their seeds and seeds react to their growing conditions. So they'll be different depending on where they're planted. And so a farmer might trade seeds, like this is, you know, I like this trait, might trade this seed with another farmer. So that kept going. And then after this decision, it's not like things locked down immediately, but what happened was the Department of Agriculture then started trying to get farmers to buy hybrid seeds that had been developed by agricultural companies. And so they were more productive. They are more productive, no question about that. But the danger is that the farmer then can't save his seeds and reproduce them. And so you have independent farmers, I mean, independent seed growers, you know, there are like the Seed Savers Exchange all over the country and the world who are trying to do that, where they are creating seed. But the danger is crossing into that area where even traits can be patented, so that the particular redness of a tomato or the quality of the purple of a carrot can be patented. And so it's just crazy. And so, I mean, the farmers have enough challenges without this as well. And so I think there is a lot of disparity and a lot of emphasis on large farms. And so the smaller farm, the mid-sized farm, they're in a fight for their life and have been for years.
Well, and I can imagine in places where people still live on a subsistence level that that could be devastating. I mean, you have to buy your seeds. That's just horrible.
Well, it is. And we've kind of done this with other countries too. It's remarkable. And I think we started down that path, and I don't think the implications were fully realized.
And so what are some of those implications?
Well, I think the biggest one, and that's what I try to get across in my book, we could lose whole crops and food sources. And a good example, and it's not as critical as wheat, but like bananas. And we have in the 50s, the type of banana that was imported, it was only a particular species or particular type of banana. And there was a parasite that attacked it. And so for a while, it was very difficult to get bananas. And so now we've kind of done the same thing. And now we all use most of the bananas that are important or imported are a Cavendish banana. And so again, it's becoming vulnerable to the same parasite, whereas it used to have a resistance. And so again, we could lose bananas. It would be sad to lose bananas, but it's not like wheat or a grain crop where that could cause worldwide hunger.
Right, right. Yeah. And so tell us a little bit more about seed banks and where they are and how connected are they with each other?
Yes. And that was, I really didn't know anything about seed banks before I started down this very long and twisted path. It's actually about 1,700 seed banks across the world. And the largest ones, there's the Millennium Seed Bank that's in England. We have one in Colorado, the Fort Collins Seed Bank. It's actually the National Lab for Genetic Resource Preservation. There's one in Peru that saves mostly potatoes and maize and quinoa. There's the Vavilov Institute in Russia, which is the oldest seed bank. And then there's the Svalbard Global Seed Vault, which is in Norway. And really, when I started writing the book, that I wanted to blow up that. And then I realized, you know nothing about Norway, and much less getting to this very isolated area. But it's what's fun is the Svalbard Seed Bank, it looks like a shipping container stuck into the side of a mountain, you know, with lights on the outside of it. And so seed banks, what they do is they are like a lending library and so, for seeds. And so all these different countries and producers will send their seeds to these seed banks, and there they're replicated. And so the idea is if anything happens, a disaster happens, the seed bank can send out replacement seeds. And this has actually happened during the Syrian war. I think it was Lebanon and a number of other Middle Eastern countries lost their seeds and potentially their agriculture. And so Svalbard was able to provide the seeds, you know, replicated seeds that they had originally given them. And they were able to recreate their architecture. I mean, architecture. Agriculture,
yeah.
Yeah.
Wow. Well, that's a real important thing for people to be doing, because if we lose all of the naturally developed seeds, then we're really dependent on artificially created seeds completely. And that seems to be, in many ways, not only less diverse, but it is frightening because they are still based on natural seeds, even if they've been adjusted in some way and they haven't been brought together from nothing. So if we lose our seeds, then we have nothing. We have to,
Exactly.
and I just can't imagine that those can be created, especially not quickly.
Well, there is this independent seed movement that they are independent seed growers who are freely sharing their seeds. There's an independent seed savers organization. So it's there, but it's certainly not, it doesn't, this movement does not have the resources that these large agricultural companies have.
Yes. Well, and the large agricultural companies are taking over more and more of the world, not just more and more of a particular country, which.
No, that was fascinating to learn that there are the four seed companies control more than 60% of all the seeds in the world. And two of them are German, one is Chinese, and one is American. And so if that doesn't make you a little uncomfortable, I don't know what could.
Right. So are you working on another book now?
I am. It's a completely different topic because the characters I would have liked to have pursued in A Place Unmade are, I don't know enough about them and their countries and things like that. So, but yes, I am working on a book. It's based in the Gulf South. It's about piracy in the southern Gulf of Mexico. So,
Oh, is it a period piece or is it modern?
it's modern. It's modern. It's so much fun to write because you get this opportunity to just dive into a particular area. And so one of, stop me if you, if I'm going on too long. But one of the things I learned was that what the Mexico and the United States have this very dysfunctional relationship, and we are illegally providing most of the guns that are used in all the drug wars. There's legal way to get guns. There's one gun store in all of Mexico, and it's controlled by the government. Everything else is brought in illegally. And so that's a little bit about what the book's about, just the,
Oh, wow.
yeah,
Does
the
it
shock.
involve any of the characters you've already developed, or are they all new?
All new. All new.
So, do you think you might be developing existing characters, or are your ideas too disparate so that those characters stay in that world and new characters have to develop in the next world?
I suspect they're going to be new. There's a couple that I might be able to bring in, but it's really a completely different topic. So no serial at this point for or subsequent book at this point for A
Well,
Place Unmade.
so I did feel that this book was kind of a mystery story. You happen to know who the villain was early on, but then the villain had to be uncovered, and so that was a kind of, that's one of the traditional structures of a mystery, to have the villain uncovered, but then the people have to find a way to. You watch them discover the clues and all of that. And so did you purposely make it into a mystery story, or is that just the way it developed?
I guess I would call it an environmental thriller,
Uh-huh.
and I wasn't able to, it was a mystery. I was always intended to be some type of mystery or thriller, but I wasn't able to keep the villain hidden from the readers. And so it's my first book. Maybe later I'll know how to do that better.
No, I don't think that there's I mean, I think it's a very traditional genre, a way to do those, or to make that presentation, where the everyone who's a reader knows who the person is, but the characters are in the dark. And so
Yes.
you watch the characters uncover everything. And so that's, I think it's traditional. So I wouldn't monkey with it.
Okay.
So did you plot it out? I mean, I'm just curious about this as a structural thing. Did you outline it, plot it out, or did you just kind of write it and then get stuck and then have to figure out what to do next? Or how did you do it?
Yes. Well, that was interesting because I started seriously writing during the pandemic, like I think a lot of people did. And I did not plot it out. It was basically this fumbling the ball down the field kind of thing. And really, one of the things that my brother, Tom, who I dedicated the book to, he and I had a little Zoom, not a Zoom, but a kind of a phone call once a week where he was writing and I was writing. We'd share our stories and then we'd talk about it. And so it really evolved over time. Like originally I wanted to go into more of the kind of New Orleans Sicilian heritage, and also more about kind of more about the Midwestern kind of agricultural development. And so I kind of started down those paths and had to, throw out pages and pages because it just didn't fit anymore with where the story went. But what I was able to do, I feel, is get across the idea of our food vulnerability. And so that was more important than my interest in pursuing more of a, New Orleans heritage and, the history of agriculture in Arizona, things like that.
So how did you do your research? Because those are challenging areas. You had all of the issues of drones. You had the issues of just how the commerce works. And you had all of the criminal issues and the different jurisdictions that would be investigating this. You had lots of different things to look at.
There really were. And it was a process. The agricultural research I started, that started first. And there was a book called Seed Wars that I read. It, the author, I think it's Keith Aioli or Aoki or something like that. This is where I'm doing a lot of buzz. I started doing the research for the agricultural portion of the book right away. And then topics would come up, like the whole criminal issue, that was much later. And so it ended up being a lot of it online. I relied on the U.S. Department of Agriculture. A lot of the land grant colleges, like the colleges in Kansas, Nebraska, they had excellent resources. And then the more I looked at that, if you look at the references, you can keep going in a particular area. So
sure.
I have probably 3 pages of references on my website where I just kept, like, one thing led to another. It was really, Alice down the rabbit hole kind of thing.
Well, I love that you listed your references because I think that that will help a lot of people whose interest is piqued by reading this book and say, I didn't know that, and I want to learn more. And of course, the references aren't in the actual book. And so the fact that they're on your website, I think, is really a gift to everyone because it puts it all together. You've done all the work, and then people just have to read the books and read the articles and such, because it's quite a lot of research. And for somebody who's very interested in seeds and wants to know more, I think that that particular section of the website is very, very helpful.
Great.
And it's not so scientific that you feel like I can't read this. So that was good.
That's great. It's really funny because that was a process that happened as well. I think initially there was a lot more science because I got really into all the geeky stuff, and was lucky enough to have beta readers and editors who said, wait a minute, where's the story?
And so, one more question. I have a question about these young characters who decide that they can solve this. And I understand that, and of course, I don't want to give it all away, but I think I would be incredibly devastated if my father had done as the villain some of this stuff that, and of course, you can't, it's not giving away the villain because the villain is exposed early on. So, if my father had been the villain in such a plot and had been the mastermind of the idea, I just don't know how I would have been able to deal with it. So I understand the impulse to fix it, but they were more interested in exposing him than fixing it. How did you work around that, these young people with not a lot of what I would call defensive skills, like they didn't know about guns and they didn't have self-defense courses and all of that sort of thing. How did they just feel like, oh, we'll just go do this? It was
Well,
kind of like, let's put on a show.
I think there was the son of the villain. He had this, well, he was first estranged from his father. So the idea of challenging him in this way was acceptable. You know, if his father had done this, he could challenge him. But I think there was also a disbelief that things could go awry. And I think that's perhaps indicative or true of many young people in their late 20s, or, you know, that whole it. I don't think they thought things could go badly. And so that's, I think, what happened. And I think that it was more of their naivete. There was just what could go wrong? I
Right.
just
Well,
think.
and they probably felt invincible still. And so even if something went wrong, they would be able to handle it no matter what
They'd
it
be
was.
okay. Right.
I found that part very charming. And I thought, oh my goodness, if my children tried to do this, well, I would just, it wouldn't work. But it's definitely, it was interesting. All of it was really, really interesting. And I, as I say, I really learned a lot from reading it. And I'm looking forward to your next book.
Oh,
So
great.
any kind of timeline, or is it just still open-ended right now?
It's pretty open-ended. I hope to finish the writing by the end of the year, but from my last experience, it took 2 years to write it and then a year of editing, and that involved five rewrites. So who knows?
Right. And the rewriting is often hard, I think. It's
Well, you've written books yourself, so yes, you're very familiar with that process, but it was brand new to me, and it took much, much longer than I ever expected. So, but
yeah.
no projections for the next one.
It makes you wonder about those people who can just turn out a book every year. That's polished and published and everything, just one after another.
I know I admire it, but it's certainly not me.
Well, yeah, tell us what your website is so everybody can find it.
CarlaSeiler.net. And so if they just put that into the search bar, it'll come up.
And your book is available everywhere.
It will be. The launch date is May 30th. And I'm also on Instagram, CarlaSeiler_author. So please follow me. It'll be on, it could be pre-ordered on Amazon, although I'm not sure when this will podcast. So it's available on Amazon through the publisher Black Rose Writing. It'll be at Blue Cypress in New Orleans, and I hope some other bookstores as well.
And so, do you think you'll be doing a signing at Blue Cypress?
Yes, actually, that's scheduled for June 3rd.
Okay. That's great to know. Well, thank you very much, and I hope everybody can get a chance to read your book.
Me
Thank
too. Thank you
you.
so much for having me.
Thanks for listening to Tip of the Tongue, a part of the Nitty Grits Network of the Southern Food and Beverage Museum. Subscribe to this and other food and drink related podcasts at southernfood.org or wherever you listen to podcasts. If you want to keep up with me, Liz Williams, you can subscribe to my Substack newsletter, also called Tip of the Tongue, for more information about this podcast, recipes, and just what is going on. I'm Liz Williams. Thanks for listening.